From Quality Radio Productions, it's the Upstate Radio Theater, an hour of sounds from radio's golden age. I'm Jake Longwell, opening the hour with an episode of Jeff Regan Investigator, also known as The Lion's Eye. This hard-boiled detective series debuted on CBS in the summer of 1948, starring Jack Webb in the lead role for the first 24 episodes. He was then replaced in 1949 by Frank Graham. This broadcast, program number 8 in the series, originally aired on August 28th, 1948. The Man in the Door.
My name's Jeff Regan. I get 10 a day and expenses from a detective bureau run by a guy named Lyon. Anthony J. Lyon. They call me the Lion's Eye.
With Jack Webb as Jeff Regan Investigator, stand by for hard-boiled action, mystery, and thrilling adventure in tonight's story of The Man in the Door.
Well, this is the way it started. The Lion called about 4 o'clock that afternoon, said he wanted to see me down at the office. I argued a while, finally told him I'd be there. Melody was sitting in front of her typewriter when I came in, putting a new coat of paint on her nails. She handed me a blank contract with no dates filled in, jerked a thumb toward the Lion's den. I went in.
Regan, I'm glad you got here. What do you know about architects?
They draw things.
I know that much, but what about bids and all that stuff?
Well, they figure out what a building's going to cost, don't they?
Go on.
If whoever's paying for the building likes what they write down, then they're hired.
A couple of architects, maybe 3 or 4, make bids.
I suppose so. Low man gets the job. Why?
Our client's an architect named Dudley Haynes, an office in the Park Central building. He thinks maybe the bank that's handling his bid might try to put something over on him.
Banks don't do things like that.
He thinks maybe a guy who works at the bank might be taking dough to shove his bid under the counter.
Why didn't you say that in the first place?
Because I'm saying it now. Haynes wants us to look into it.
Who do I see?
Haynes first. I only talked to him on the phone. I told him we'd have to have a contract and retainer before we did anything.
That figures.
So hop over there and find out what's what and make him sign that contract and get a check.
Anything else?
Make sure it's certified and call me if you run into any trouble.
Dudley Haynes, architect, Park Central building, had an office on the 9th floor. When I went in, a girl with hair that figured to be blonde right down to the roots pulled off her glasses and put out her cigarette. And she kind of eased out of her chair behind that desk, moved toward me, like a panther looking for a meal.
My, you're tall, aren't you?
Well, there's nothing I can do about that.
Mr. Lyon said he was sending us one of his best men.
He always says that.
I think he meant it this time.
He's an awful liar, lady.
Dorothy. Dorothy Nolan.
Fitz.
The name or the dress?
Both.
What's yours?
Jeff Regan.
Oh. Well, now we know each other.
That's nice. I came to see Haynes. He wants me to look into something for him.
I know.
He's expecting it.
I know.
Well?
I hope you have to look into a lot of things.
For Haynes?
No.
This is his office, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. But he spends most of his time in 902 into the hall. Makes his blueprints up there. I'll take you. You are tall.
Well, we started down the hall. We got about 10 feet from the frosted glass door at the end. We both stopped. We were looking at the outline of a big man behind the door. Both of us expected him to open it and walk out. Oh, he came out all right, but he walked right through it. Oh, he's been shot.
Oh.
You know him?
It's my boss, Mr. Haynes.
No, it was your boss, lady. He's dead. Lieutenant Salvatore Wendetti, Central Homicide Detail, showed up about 8 minutes after I called. He had his whole goon squad with him and a couple of guys in double-breasted suits from the district attorney's office. They roped off the entrance to the building, got hold of the elevator operators and the man who runs the cigar stand, and asked some questions. Then, when Deddy looked at what was left of Haynes,
okay,
he started yelling into a phone.
Okay, you can set a basket over, but don't move until my fingerprint boys get through. Yeah. Okay, sis, where the guy live?
At the Biltmore Hotel.
Where's his wife?
We didn't have one.
What do we tell?
We didn't have any family.
So no one's going to cry. Well, that makes it easier. Regan, was he your client?
No, nobody's a client until they sign a contract, Sally.
Well, you would bring him a contract to sign, and then you would do something for him. What?
Well, I didn't talk to him.
Sis?
Well, Mr. Haynes had made an estimate on a little office building in Beverly Hills. He thought that a man named Adler at the bank might be taking money from someone to hold his bid out.
So he wants an investigator to look into it. Why do you think that?
Well, I don't know.
You work for him.
Well, I don't know everything.
Neither do I. Hot, isn't it? Who's Adler?
Oh, just a name to me.
Who else?
Who else?
Architects. Who else was making a bid?
I don't know that.
Now, where are we? Kelly!
Yes?
Guy named Adler at the
Grand National Bank.
Pick him up and have him down to my office in half an hour.
Yes? What do you want to do about reporters, Sally?
Tell him to go jump in the lake.
Yes?
They always spell my name wrong. How long you two known each other?
An hour.
Nice.
What do you mean by that?
Just nice. Didn't hear any shots?
No, we didn't.
Tell me more about the bid.
Well, what's there to tell?
The setup.
Well, the bank handles the money.
Who says yes? Who says no?
The bank, but...
But what?
The contractor usually tells them who to take.
Huh? Who's that in this case?
A contractor in Long Beach. His name is George Cantrell.
I'll say this for you, Regan. When you get mixed up in anything, you're starting to get mixed up with the good-looking people.
I'm not mixed up in anything.
What do you say, sis?
I'll keep my mouth shut.
She's a smart girl, Regan. Hello, honey. Won't be home for dinner. Some guy got himself killed and I'm in on it. Not long, how? Regan? I'll tell him. Wife says hello. Says come out to dinner sometime. Whoop! Sis, how much that contract worth?
Oh, on the building in Beverly Hills, about $40,000.
Profit?
No, overall.
Break it out.
Well, Mr. Haynes would have cleared about $12,000 if he'd gotten
it. I know some guys are killed for a dime. Sam, when Daddy? I'm still at the Park Central building. Get out to Long Beach and talk to a contractor named George Cantrell. And find out what architects were making business and stuff he was going to put up in Beverly Hills. Yeah, get the name. Okay, that about does it. Let's go. Miss Nolan?
What?
Have to take you down.
Jeff, can you do that?
You're a material witness.
Well, what are you?
He's a bystander with a built-in lawyer.
Well, I do, Jeff.
Go with him.
Why do I want to spend the night in jail? I just worked for Mr. Haynes.
No phone call. This is a murder case.
Well, get me a lawyer or something, Jeff.
You know a lawyer?
No. Wait, yes, I do. His name's Dave Henderson. He lives at 1648 Claremont Place. Will you get for me, tell him I'm in trouble?
Yeah. Check, Sally.
She didn't make a phone call, and I like her, too.
Well, look, he may not be able to do anything for you tonight. It's almost six.
But you'll see him as soon as possible?
Yeah.
Tell him I'm scared, Jeff. I'm scared, Steve.
Well, I stayed there and phoned the Lion, told him what had happened. Well, he got mad and yelled something about me being a jinx on all our clients, and then he hung up. So I went through the classified telephone directory under attorneys and Henderson. There was a Ben, a George, a Joe, a William, but no Dave Henderson. So I drove out to the address that she'd given me. It was a blue apartment house four blocks west of Vermont over by the Coliseum. Somebody was cooking hamburgers somewhere. And somebody was all worked up over a ball game on the radio. I picked the baseball fan.
Well, what'll happen now is anybody's guess, but let me tell you that this ball game is a long way from being up. Hey, what'd I tell you? It's outside the ballpark, and they're coming in like homing pigeons. Bases are loaded, and they're all coming in. Oh, it's going to be 8-5.
Come on, the ball game's not that good.
What's so important, Pilgrim? I'm with the ball game.
I'm looking for a man named Dave Henderson, a lawyer.
So what?
Somebody told me he lives in this apartment house.
Who told you that?
A lady.
Huh?
Does he live here?
You try looking at the mailbox?
No name.
You cop?
Private type.
Huh?
Does he live here?
Sure he lives here.
Well, where?
End of the hall, 106.
Thanks.
So he's a lawyer, is he? With his kind of friends? Huh?
What does that mean?
You're young, ain't you, Curly?
I got a driver's license.
Let me tell you something. Don't go knocking on no doors and hear a ball game. Remember that.
Yeah, I'll remember
that. And you can tell him Tessie Bogart is not to that one.
And the score is 8-5 coming into the first half of the ninth, and this has been some ball game, let me tell you.
No six. Here we are.
Come on in, it's unlocked.
Your name, Dave Henderson?
Yeah, who wants to know?
My name's Regan. I'm a private investigator with the International Detective Bureau.
Wrong steer, Gumshoe. I don't need one.
Look, I'm not looking for work. I'm looking for you.
What'd you say it was? Regan?
That's right.
R-E-G-A-N, Regan. Regan. Learned that just an hour ago. Cute, huh?
I met a friend of yours today.
Dave Henderson never had a pet.
She said she was a friend of yours.
But I didn't say I was a friend of hers. Hey, who are we talking about anyway?
Dorothy Nolan.
How is Dorothy?
Not so good.
Thought you were a detective.
I am.
You sound like a doctor.
Look, you sound like a guy with a chip on his shoulder.
Sound like a lot of things. You're trying to be tough, Pete.
No wonder you aren't in the telephone directory.
I'll just skip that.
She said you were a lawyer.
They say I drink too much. Haven't seen you drinking, have you?
She wants you to get in touch with her. The man she was working for was murdered today.
She kill him?
Well, they're holding her.
Material witness or suspect?
Material witness right now. She doesn't want to spend the night in jail.
Who does? That's why she isn't feeling so good, huh? He wants me to get her out.
Something like that.
Who's handling the case downtown?
A detective named Wendetti.
Yeah, and where do you come in?
Well, he didn't give her that one phone call.
Yeah. You're sensitive. What if I said no?
Well, that's your business.
You know why she asked you to see me? Because I'm a guy she knows. And every guy who knows little Dorothy has a little something for her. Have you met him like that, Regan?
Sometimes.
I'm just checking.
Checking what?
She's pretty good with the works. Eyes just right for the job. Hair just right. Everything just right. She can make you do a lot of things you don't want to do. Wait till you see her in a bathing suit. Ooh, that's something, brother.
Well, they aren't wearing them in the county jail.
Okay, I'll phone Wendetti and find out what her bond is.
Look, this is a murder case. There's no bond on this. You know that.
Well, it depends how you handle it. I'll think of something.
Yeah, I'll bet you will.
We don't like each other much, do we?
Nope.
That's the way it goes.
Listen, she said to tell you she was scared.
Well, some of us are scared part of the time. And somebody gets shot. And everybody gets scared. You scared?
Nope.
Iron Man Regan. Have a good time.
Did I say Haynes was shot?
No. You didn't say a thing. See you somewhere, Peter.
Well, I stopped by Musso Frank's and had the special, and then I went on home. I tried to make a couple of calls, but Wendetti was out, and the desk sergeant thought I was a reporter, and he wouldn't tell me a thing about Dorothy Nolan. While I was sitting there, the phone began jumping around on the hook.
Regan?
Yeah?
This is me. Where you been? I called your place 20 times, but I've called it once.
Well, I've been busy seeing a lawyer.
What do you need a lawyer for? You aren't married.
Somebody else needs one.
Who?
Dorothy Nolan, that blonde who worked up in Haynes' office when Daddy's holding her.
Good. I want you to go down and see her.
What for?
We can still make something on this thing if we play it smart. When I talked to Haynes on the phone this afternoon, I told him I wanted a certified check.
So what?
So that means there's a check for $100 lying around his office somewhere. And it's made out to International.
Look, he's dead, remember?
Everybody dies. Don't worry about it.
We weren't even hired.
We had a verbal contract.
We had nothing.
That check's no good to anybody but us.
We didn't do anything for him.
Well, buy him some flowers. Now hop down to the pokey and see that dame and find out where that check is.
We can't do that.
I talked to Harry Presidio and he'll give us a lien to get in. Hello? Hello? Regan, you're still there.
I was still there, Hello? But I wasn't listening to the lion. I was looking at a skinny little man with one leg.
Hey, Regan, you're still there.
Now don't ask me how he made it inside my door. He was just there. Propped up on a pair of crutches, swaying back and forth, watching me with a couple of sick gray eyes that were so full of water you'd think they were going to float right out of his head. All at once, he went down like a busted sugar sack. He'd been shot twice through the neck with a small caliber gun, a 25, 32, I don't know. I found a dozen razor blades in one pocket and two dozen sets of shoelaces to go with them. There wasn't anything that told me his name, but there was a picture inside his shirt pocket. One of those things that you have taken in a penny arcade, you know, in front of phony pasteboard props. Well, a man with one leg was looking out from between a pair of painted angel's wings. And the guy standing next to him, who was smiling up at the halo, was the same man that I'd seen that afternoon. An architect named Haynes. A man who needed the private detective. A man who walked out a glass door and then dropped dead. and the one printed word above that picture stuck like a wart on an egg that said, Happy Land.
You are listening to the story of the man in the door, tonight's adventure with Jeff Regan, investigator. Here is a special and important message to every businessman listening. To every businessman, regardless of the size or the type of his business. Gentlemen, do you realize that the schools of this community help you every day that you're in business? That's right. For one thing, our schools teach the boys and girls of this community to cherish the human rights, the free enterprise on which our country and your business are founded. With each new generation graduated from our schools, the Army defending our way of life and your business grows stronger. What's more, good teachers and well-equipped schools do a better job of developing our children's talents. The result? School graduates have become more skilled and more efficient employees. So remember, any time and taxes that you contribute to improving local schools are an investment in your own business future. Education is good business. Education can maintain our freedom. And freedom is everybody's job. And now, back to the story of the man in the door and Jeff Regan, investigator.
Well, I left the little man with the one leg lying there. Wasn't much I could do for him. I wanted to wait before I called homicide. I took the picture I found in his pocket and I drove to Happy Land. It turned out to be an open-air penny arcade on 5th and Main. Smelled like all the hot dogs in the world had been made right there. There were machines all over the place telling you how strong you were, how rich you'd be, and who you'd marry. All for a penny. I guess it wasn't much of a bargain. The only customer was a sailor trying his luck at the shooting gallery. Back in the corner, a tired-looking girl in light blue slacks and a dirty gray sweater was sitting on a stool by the hot dog counter staring at nothing.
Want some pennies?
Not right now, no.
Oh, just looking? Go ahead. When you figure out where you're going to spend your money, come back and I'll give you some change.
You got a picture gallery here?
Oh. Don't tell me you're a real big spender and want to have your picture taken.
Maybe. You got one?
Yeah, we got one.
Where is it?
In there. If you really want to get your picture taken, I'll climb off this stool and take you back. I want to tell you now, if you're just trying to be sociable, you can go and fly a kite.
You run the picture concession?
I run the picture place and the hot dog place, and I sweep out in the morning. Oh, I wish I had better brains than to marry that slob and get myself stuck in a cheap dump like this.
All right. You remember taking this picture?
How would I know? I take a lot of pictures.
Well, come on, look at it.
All right. Yeah, I took it. That what sold you?
When?
How do you think I am? Can't remember what night it is every time a pair of drunks comes in and wants their pictures taken together.
Well, try to remember, will you?
You're a real wise guy, mister. You don't want no picture. You just want some talk. You're a cop.
Friend. I met the little guy in the picture once.
Dusty.
What was that?
I thought you said you met him once.
Well, we weren't introduced. I just met him. Who is he?
Dusty Rhodes. Works the circuit.
What circuit?
5th and Main, STEM. Business section.
What kind of business?
Dusty handled the razor blade and shoelace traffic. He hates pencils.
What'd he do when he wasn't working?
What does anybody do? You went out and got loaded.
Go on.
And you don't know him very well for a friend. How am I going to know I'm not getting Dusty in trouble talking to you like this?
Nobody can get him in trouble anymore, lady.
What do you mean?
He was shot tonight.
Oh, no. Oh, poor little guy.
Do you know where he lived?
Seashore Hotel. The Seashore Hotel. Oh, Jesus, I'm sick. Oh, I'm real sick.
of the seashore caters to many types of people, good and bad, just out of the pokey. 2 bits a night for transients, $150 a week for solid citizens. And sign and register, it's a law.
I'm not looking for a room.
Then you're wasting my time, brother. My beer's getting warm.
Look, I'm a private investigator. My name's Regan.
I liked you before you said them 2 words, brother, but you have soured me. Private investigator means private eye, and it all means cop. And you are not welcome. Now blow.
I'm trying to find out something about a man named Dusty Road.
We do not ask questions, and we do not give answers. Now blow.
I was told he lived here.
You find me tongueless, brother. Now blow.
Did you know him?
During the last 5 years, I have acquired 85 pounds and a very bad heart. All right, have you in the alley right now.
Oh, yeah, sure you would. Here.
Abraham Lincoln was a very fine man, and he took a very fine picture. I seem to have found my tongue, brother. Will it be?
The key to his room, for a starter, huh?
Disallowable and punishable by fine and imprisonment. Into the hall, turn the Ben Fest door to the right.
Thanks. Well, I don't know what I expected to find there, outside of more razor blades and more shoelaces, with a little room full of dirty white curtains and a wire bed that sagged in the middle. I was standing there watching a neon sign advertise beer a block down the street when I thought I heard somebody behind me. Whoever it was had been drinking bad whiskey, but he was still pretty good. It landed a quarter of an inch above my right ear, and I piled up in a lamp, a chair, and a pitcher full of water.
5 berries get you a look, brother, but doesn't get you a room. Besides, it's already taken and the bed's over there. Now, come on. Yeah, you didn't go to sleep, brother. You was knocked to sleep.
Oh.
I apologize. What a game.
Who came in after me?
You're the only one.
You sure?
My name's Sam Preacher. Brother, I'm very sure.
Well, maybe he was waiting for me, huh?
I don't generally ask him, but the question is this. Why?
Oh, I don't know. Unless...
What's the matter? Something missing?
Just a picture.
You can get lots of pictures.
You didn't see anybody?
That makes the third time, brother, and the answer's still negative.
Okay, okay.
Then let's blow, buddy, huh?
Coroner's office.
Luke, this is Regan.
The lion's eye. What's with your baby? When Daddy tells me you walked into one today.
Yeah, I did. You got him there?
Haynes Dudley? Sure. Want to come down and take a look? He's toe-tagged and salted out real pretty.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Them 32 slugs was just incidental. The guy had 4 weeks at the outside.
All right, give it to me.
Haynes Dudley was dying from malnutrition, alcoholism, and a couple other things with long names.
Give me one long name.
Diabetes. He didn't take good care of himself, funny, huh?
A misspent life.
Somebody's gonna take the gas chamber for nothing.
When did he know this?
Sure, sure. And he was wearing a brand new suit, too. We'll sew up the holes, we'll bury him in it.
Well, you aren't finished yet, Luke.
Baby!
A guy with one leg dropped dead in my place a couple hours ago.
It's after 11.
Well, I'm sorry, Luke.
They connected?
Yeah.
Murder?
Yeah.
Well, come down and see us anytime, Regan. We're open 24 hours a day.
Fell at the homicide office. They told me she'd been released about 10 o'clock. They said a lawyer named Henderson had put up the bail and handled the whole thing. They gave me an address on her when I went out there. It was a bungalow court on Normandy, and it took her a long time to answer the door.
Oh. You?
Yeah, tell me how tall I am.
Well, I'd love to, but not right now.
They told me you'd been out since 10 o'clock. Maybe I should have come sooner.
Dale gives me the willies. I'm about to take a shower.
I was kind of hoping we could have a drink.
I did better than I thought with you.
I got a hold of a lawyer for you, didn't I?
Yeah.
Well, doesn't that rate me an invitation to have a drink?
I said later. I'm really tired.
I said no.
Wait a minute. Well, if you're that thirsty, all right.
That's better.
Isn't every day my boss gets killed and I meet a private detective?
I need a drink. I was slugged tonight.
Slugged?
Yeah, right here, see?
Oh, it looks nasty. Why'd anyone do that to you?
Wanted a picture I had.
Whistler's mother?
Just a picture of a couple of drunks who are dead now.
Maybe whoever did it was a relative.
Guess again.
I don't like games.
But you play them all the time.
But we all, I know a psychiatrist who says we can't help ourselves.
You can.
I liked you when you walked into the office this afternoon, but I'm not so sure I like you now. Maybe you better go.
Expecting somebody, huh?
What are you doing? You let go of me. Let go of me.
Oh, no, baby. You've got real nice eyes. I want to look at them.
Let go. He's crazy. You.
Hello, Dave. We didn't hear you knock. Did you bring your piano?
What's the idea?
He gave it.
Why don't you tell him to go away, baby? Anybody can tell we're busy.
Let it go, Regan.
You want to break us up?
Can't you see he's just trying to make you jealous and say things?
Come here, honey.
No! You don't have to do that.
I said let her go.
Is that the same .32 you killed the one-legged man with?
Over, gumshoe.
Don't be a fool.
Stay right where you are, baby. You're first.
Listen to me, baby.
I listen to you too long.
He's only guessing. He doesn't have any proof of anything.
You can cry if you want to, baby. This is going to hurt.
She spun around and fell into a coffee table and then lay very quiet on the rug. Her eyes were open and she didn't say anything. She just lay there looking up at him. I couldn't tell where she'd been hit. He seemed to forget all about me because he walked over to her, knelt down beside her, put the gun right up against her head.
This is awful close range, baby, but I can't afford to miss.
Neither could I. Well, when Daddy and I stuck our heads together and it all came out when we looked into a couple of things. You see, Dave Henderson was Dudley Haynes, and he was wanted for attempted murder and embezzling and one thing or another back in Ohio. So he figured it'd be a good idea to bump himself off. Dorothy helped him with the idea. They both went down on Main Street, and they picked up an old bum, dressed him up in a new suit, and shot him. I was supposed to walk in with Dorothy, and she'd identify the body, and as far as anybody knew, Dudley Haynes would be dead. Dave didn't figure that she'd be taken down. She didn't figure that she'd get scared, and neither of them figured the man with one leg was a pal of the man that they'd shot. Well, it seems that they'd looked through a lot of files, and they'd figured that a lot of murders go unsolved. Maybe they do. I don't know. Well, anyway, he sat down on that little bench up there in San Quentin last week. The one with that bucket of acid in the room. Well, he held his breath as long as he could, but everybody has to breathe. He's buried up there with a lot of other guys that figured they could get away with murder. Dorothy? She wasn't hurt too bad. They had her in a wheelchair for the trial. She got 15 years as an accomplice. Some kind of a deal. State's evidence and all that. I don't think I'll wait for her. She wasn't that good.
Jack Webb is featured as Jeff Regan, with Wilms Herbert as Anthony J. Lyon. It's CBS at 9:30 next week for more hard-boiled action and mystery with Jeff Regan, Investigator. Written by E. Jack Newman and produced by Sterling Tracy. Dorothy Nolan was played by Betty Lou Gerson, and David Ellis was Dave Henderson. Lorene Tuttle, William Conrad, and Lou Krugman supported. It's perfectly natural and wholesome for some men who want to leave great wealth behind. There's a druggist in a small town in Pennsylvania who'll do that. The wealth he'll leave behind will make many lives easier and happier and finer down through the years. For he was the principal donor of an outdoor meeting place for religious services in a Boy Scout camp in the Poconos. Working with his neighbors in community activities, he saw the need of this improvement, helped to install it. That's the kind of wealth that you can bequeath to generations coming on as you enjoy the freedom of working with your neighbors for the betterment of your community. Freedom that can be anybody's pleasure is everybody's job. Music for this program is arranged by Dick Arant. Next week at 9:30, Jeff Regan, Investigator, brings you another thrill-packed half-hour with his story of the House by the Sea. Bob Stevenson speaking. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
The Man in the Door, Episode 8 in the series Jeff Regan, Investigator, from August 28th, 1948. It's the Upstate Radio Theater. I'm Jake Longwell. If you want to get in touch, Our email address is qualityradioproductions@gmail.com. And our website, qualityradioproductions.blogspot.com. This is program number 1923. We have episodes from two syndicated broadcasts to conclude this hour of old-time radio. Starting off with The Player, a series of short radio dramas written especially for the versatile voice actor Paul Frees. The syndicated series, also from 1948, but no specific dates for any of these episodes. A long-running series at that. This is program number 80. It's called Fate Upsets a Plan.
Theodore Clark looked up at the huge gray columns of cement that adorned the front of the city's largest banking institution. He'd paused there for a moment just before going to meet James Kenyon, with whom he'd taken lunch every day for the past 2 years. And now standing there in speculative manner, he realized that the time was ripe to put into effect the plan he had so painstakingly labored over for that lengthy period of time. Theodore Clark was going to rob this bank of $100,000.
And thus we begin another story by The Player, starring America's most versatile actor, Mr. Paul Frees. We'll be with you after a worthwhile message from your announcer. The Player, Mr. Paul Frees.
How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? This is The Player, welcoming you to our presentation of Fate Upsets a Plan. All his life, Theodore Clark had wanted $100,000. Ever since early youth, he had dreamed of the day when he'd be able to have what he considered a reasonable amount of money to spend in his declining years in comfort and luxury. For purely selfish reasons, he had never married. And so middle age was upon him, and toward the goal that he had planned for himself, there was nothing, absolutely nothing set aside. And that was when the thought came to steal $100,000. He had met James Kenyon, a lonely individual like himself, a middle-aged teller in this great bank. Several times when the huge building was empty, Clark would wait beside the cage in which Kenyon worked late at night and watch the teller carry the day's deposits to the massive vault. Kenyon was a trusted employee of the bank with 30 years' service and was the last one at night who closed the vault and set the time lock. And he was the first in the morning who opened it. And he, Theodore Clark, was going to spend the night locked in that huge vault. And Clark hadn't overlooked a single feature that might spell danger, even to the extent of studying how many cubic inches of air he would consume while he was a 9-hour prisoner in the airproof chamber. Oh, it was a great plan. Poor unsuspecting Kenyon would open the vault door early in the morning before any of the other employees were there. He would enter. Clark would have the necessary implement on hand to dispose of the innocent teller. And the required amount of cash taken from one of the steel drawers would be in his pocket. Kenyon's body could easily be hidden in one of the lockers downstairs, and before anyone could make any kind of discovery, Clark would be well on his way out of the city. And so this was how the situation stood when Theodore Clark met his friend Kenyon, the teller, on this bright sunny day, and proceeded toward their favorite dining establishment. It was while they were seated, engaged in eating, that Clark discussed a point with Kenyon.
Ah, my good friend. I wonder if you'd be interested in attending a lecture with me this evening.
The schemer already knew what the bank teller's answer would be.
Oh, I'd like to very much, Mr. Clark. But you see, this is the middle of the month. Statements are mailed at this time, and everyone leaves the bank, and I have a great deal of work to do.
Oh, that's too bad. I'm sure you would have found it interesting. Dr. Whiting is speaking at the Group Institute, you know.
Yes, I should like very much to have gone, but, well, you know how it is.
Oh, I'll tell you what I'll do. I shall attend the lecture, then call for you at the bank, and on the way home we shall discuss it at length, eh?
Yes, yes, that would be an excellent idea. Then I shall expect you to call for me at the bank late this evening, hmm? You can use the usual rear entrance, come directly to my case, and I'll let you in the door.
Clark left the teller and returned to his work as bookkeeper in the large insurance office further downtown. At 5 o'clock, he went home and prepared for the night's activities. Placing a small flashlight in his pocket, he paused for a moment to examine the weapon he would use on Kenyon. It was an 8-inch length of thick wire looped at one end to hold a round lump of lead and strapped with tape. Concealing the weapon in his clothes, Clark left his dingy apartment and headed for the street. He walked several blocks and dropped into a movie. At exactly 10:15, he left and went to the bank and made his way up the alley in the rear to the small employee's door. Entering, he crossed the wide marble corridor and walked to the teller's cage in which Kenyon was busily occupied.
Hello, my good friend.
The teller looked up.
Oh, well, Mr. Clark, right on time, I see. Did you attend the lecture?
Yes, Mr. Kenyon. Very interesting it was, too. May I come in?
Yes, of course you may. Just walk to the door and I'll meet you there.
Kenyon left his window, walked along behind the long tier of teller cages, and admitted Clark to the inner confines of the transit block. Clark sat on a small stool and watched while Kenyon went over his books.
Oh, by the way, Mr. Kenyon, what time is it?
It's nearly 11 o'clock. Why?
Oh, my. I promised to keep another engagement at this very time. Oh, I must hurry.
But, Mr. Clark, I'm nearly finished. All I have to do is place this money in the vault, check my ledgers once more, and close the vault door.
Kenyon wasn't telling him anything he didn't know. Hadn't he watched the little teller go through this procedure countless times before in the preceding 2 years?
Well, I'm afraid I won't have time to wait, Mr. Kenyon.
Oh, well, I'm sorry you have to leave.
But perhaps we can meet again another time, eh?
Very well, Mr. Clark. We shall do that.
The two men walked a short distance together and then their paths divided. The teller headed for the vault and Clark started for the door. They exchanged good nights and Clark watched while Kenyon disappeared into the steel chamber. Quickly, he opened the door and instead of going out, he stepped back and flattened himself against the wall. And then the door clicked shut. Kenyon emerged from the vault, and Clark thought of how easy it would be to make a break for the money now. But the lights. The building was flooded with light, and Kenyon was the only one who knew where the switch was. Perhaps it was just as well. In the morning, it would be easier. With only a few short steps, Clark was inside the vault. Concealing himself against one of the plate steel wall sidings, Clark heard the teller approach the entrance once more. He held his breath as a switch clicked off the lights and then watched while the small stream of light outside narrowed as the great door closed. Suddenly it was pitch dark and Clark heard the time lock tumblers fall into place. Now his all-night vigil was to begin. Without a moment's hesitation, he spotted his flashlight on one of the great steel drawers and tugged at the handle. It didn't open. A wave of panic swept over Clark as he wrenched and pulled at one drawer and then at the others. Every one of them refused to budge. So, the time lock controlled the currency drawers too. Fear. Cold, unmerciful fear seized the imprisoned man. He made a dash for the massive door, and in his frantic pounding, he smashed the flashlight in his hand. Suddenly, he realized he was breathing heavily. This had to stop. He was using all the air in the chamber. He slid down to the floor in a sitting position, and for the sake of bravado, he began talking to himself.
Take it easy, you fool. You're going to get out of here? Kenyon will be here at 8 a.m, early, before any of the others. There's enough air till then. Sure. Sure, and you'll get your money, too. When he releases the time lock on the door, it will automatically release the currency drawers. That's when you get the money, after you take care of Kenyon first. You've got to be patient, that's all. Just a little patient. Now, lay down on the floor and breathe slowly and evenly. Use your head. Everything will be all right.
Clark obeyed his own voice and laid prone on the cold floor, breathing with as little depth as possible. But it was torture. Each minute seemed to be an eternity. In order to offset the occasional intervals of oncoming fear that he would experience, Clark began to dream of what he would do with his $100,000. Oh, it would be so wonderful, never to have to worry or care about anything. Days of nothing to do but lay around living the life of a country gentleman. Nights of gaiety and enjoyment. His musings eventually gave way to a gradual knowledge of the fact that a great deal of time had passed. He rose to his feet and listened. No sound. Nothing. Clark noticed that his breathing was becoming more and more laborious, without his being able to control it. Pounding started in his ears, and he could feel the blood rising in his head. He coughed a little and loosened his collar, but it didn't help any. He lay down once more and rose again. Then, with the full impact of terrifying horror, Theodore Clark realized that he was choking to death. He had to have air. He clawed at his collar and opened his mouth in a vain effort to inhale. An uncontrollable fit of coughing seized him and his senses began to reel. He sank to his knees and groped with clenched fingers in the dark. Then he flattened out, writhed in excruciating pain, and lay still. They found Theodore Clark eventually with his bloody fingernails hooked over the smooth surface of the steel floor. His face was a ghastly thing to behold, and it was evident that he had died a horrible death. James Kenyon, the bank teller, was questioned, and the innocence of the little man's statement gave bank officials reason to exonerate him from all blame. You see, there was one thing that Theodore Clark had failed to remember when he entered the great steel vault to spend the night waiting for the teller to open it the following morning. He didn't know that the time clock had been set for 2 days later, because the next day was a holiday, and the bank did not open.
And that's another play by The Player, your one-man theater, Paul Frees, who portrays all of the parts. Mr. Frees will return after a short visit with your announcer.
Fate Upsets a Plan was written by Walter Gehring and produced by Sam Kerner, with music composed and performed by Rami Idris. Special effects by Fred Cole. Your announcer was Gary Goodwin. This is The Player, Paul Frees, saying goodbye until next we meet.
Fate Upsets a Plan, an episode of The Player, a dramatic series starring Paul Frees from 1948. Finally, an episode of The Origin of Superstition. This syndicated series is from 1935, and as the title suggests, it's a series of dramatizations based on popular superstitions that most of us are familiar with, including this one, episode 13 in the series, aptly titled The Origin of Friday the 13th.
Superstition on the air.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is our pleasure to offer you another short story in the series designed to disclose the origins of superstition. This one deals with the belief that Friday the 13th is an unlucky day.
Henry, aren't you ready yet? Your breakfast will get cold. Hurry now.
I'll be with you in a minute, Doris.
Oh, every time you have a day off, Henry, it takes hours before I can get the housework started, and it upsets all
my... Oh, darling, I'm sorry. But you know, I only have a day off once every 2 weeks. Well, do I get those nice hot biscuits for breakfast?
Yes, dear. Here, read the morning paper while I get them out of the oven.
All right, honey, but make it snappy. I've got to meet Bill out at the club for a game of golf.
Here are the biscuits and your ham and eggs. Now eat them before they get...
Great Scott! Can you beat that?
What's the matter, Henry?
Do you know what day this is?
No.
It's Friday the 13th.
Well, what's wrong with that, dear?
What's wrong? Why, it's unlucky. Now I bet everything will go haywire today. I know I'll have some bad luck.
Oh, why, darling, just because it's Friday the 13th, it's no different from any other day.
Oh, yes, it is. I look at the disasters that happened on that day in England, right here in our own country.
Oh, but, darling, those things would have taken place anyway, regardless of the day. Just as the incident that was responsible for starting that belief would have occurred whether it had been Friday the 13th or not. So don't be superstitious.
Superstitious? Why, Doris, you know I'm not superstitious. But I'll bet Friday the 13th has been a jinx to mankind since the creation of the world.
Oh, no, Henry. You're wrong. That superstition began much later than that. It was after the passion and crucifixion of the Christ that the superstition of that day and number became universally feared as an omen of evil.
You mean they didn't regard Friday the 13th as unlucky before that time?
No. Oh, true, the belief of lucky and unlucky days and numbers had begun with the old Chaldeans and Egyptians. But the actual superstition of Friday the 13th did not begin until after the crucifixion. For people believed that because 13 sat down to the Last Supper, Jesus Christ was betrayed and crucified the following day, which was Friday the 13th of Nisan by the Jewish calendar.
Which only proves that Friday the 13th was unlucky, Doris.
No, Henry. But don't you remember in the Bible that before the feast of the Passover, Judas had gone into the city of Jerusalem and had bargained with the priests who hated the Christ because he was hailed by the people as a prophet? And they agreed to pay Judas 30 pieces of silver if he would deliver the Christ to them when he was away from the multitudes. After the Last Supper, Judas left Jesus and his disciples and went to the temple where the priests were excitedly discussing the growing power of the Christ and...
Silence, my brethren! Silence! We must do away with this man, Jesus of Nazareth, for each day his power grows and he gains more followers.
Yea, Caiaphas, only the other day the people did hail him as the son of David. 'Tis blasphemy.
'Tis sacrilege.
He is an impostor.
Let us take him. Nay, we cannot seize him while he's amongst the people who love him and call him master.
But Caiaphas, what of this Judas Iscariot, to whom we paid 30 pieces of silver? He promised to deliver this Jesus of Nazareth unto us.
Yea, Joshua, but we must have patience, for I did caution him to wait until the time that his master would be alone, so as not to cause a tumult among the people.
Caiaphas! Caiaphas! Judas Iscariot is here. He would speak with thee.
Bring him before me at once. Now, my brethren, perhaps this Judas brings the news we are waiting for. Greetings, Judas Iscariot. Hath thou brought good tidings unto us?
Yea, Caiaphas. Tonight as we sat at supper, I learned that the master doth go into the Garden of Gethsemane this night to pray there, alone. Now is the time to take him.
At last! But, Judas, how will the soldiers know thy master?
I will go with them and greet the master with a kiss. By that sign they will know him.
'Tis well spoken, Judas. Verily thou art the true savior of Israel. Now thou must go with the soldiers to seize this Jesus of Nazareth before he suspects that something may be amiss by thy absence and elude us.
Nay, Caiaphas, the master doth know I will betray him.
What? Meanest thou hast allowed him to suspect thee?
Nay, but at supper tonight he did prophesy that one of his disciples would betray him. And when we all asked who it was, he said softly unto me, "What thou doest, do quickly."
And did the others know 'twas thou who would betray him, Judas?
Nay, for he whispered unto me. And when I left, the disciples thought that I did go on an errand for the master.
Oh, then we must act quickly, for verily this man is empowered by the Prince of Darkness. Elias, take Judas to the soldiers, now, so that they may go at once to seize his master.
Yea, Caiaphas, come with me, Judas.
But Caiaphas, dost thou not fear that the people will cause a tumult when they learn that their master hath been taken?
We must prevent that, Joshua.
But how, Caiaphas?
Thou and the other priests must stir up the people to lust for his blood. 'Tis easy to sway the emotions of a mob if ye work cleverly and carefully.
Ah, thou art wise, Caiaphas.
We must act quickly, Joshua, and crucify this man before another sun sets. Otherwise, 'twill be too late, for the holy Sabbath begins then.
Thou art right, Caiaphas. We can do nothing on the holy Sabbath. 'Twould be a sacrilege.
Nay, Joshua, but we must not fail. Tomorrow, Friday the 13th of Nisan, we will have crucified this Jesus of Nazareth upon the Mount of Golgotha, the place of the skull.
But, Joshua, why should this Jesus of Nazareth be dying now upon the cross, when he hath done nothing?
Thou art a Roman, Lucius, and thou dost not understand. This man hath called himself the King of the Jews and the Son of God. 'Tis blasphemy.
But, Joshua, I have heard that he hath performed many wonders and done much good among the people.
Ah, Lucius, he did say he would destroy the temple and rebuild it again in 3 days. And now thou seest, he cannot even save himself.
But behold, Joshua, his followers at the foot of the cross, how they love him and weep at his travail.
He trusted in God, Lucius. Let God deliver him now, if he will have him. For did he not say, "I am the Son of God"? But see, he dies instead.
Yea, verily. Oh, how darkly overcast is the sky, Joshua. And each hour it doth grow more black.
Yea, Lucius. And the evening hath not yet come. But look at Jesus of Nazareth. He is dead now. for the soldier hath pierced his side with a spear.
Behold, Joshua, the rocks are rent asunder. The earth doth tremble and the skies roar with a mighty wrath. Truly, this man was the Son of God.
Verily, Lucius, I cannot understand. See the people, how they cry out with fear and beat their breasts.
Alas, Joshua, this day, Friday the 13th, will go down in the records of time as a day of ill omen. For verily, we have crucified the Son of God.
And so, after the crucifixion of the Christ, the people believe that Friday the 13th was a day of ill omen. But as you know, Henry, the day itself had nothing to do with it.
Why, you're wrong, Doris. After all, it was an unlucky day. The people turned against the Christ and crucified him, didn't they?
Oh, but Henry, don't you understand that the Christ was destined to be crucified, regardless of whether it was Friday the 13th or any other day?
Yeah, but someone's at the door.
Oh.
I'll see who it is, honey.
Telegram, sir. Will you sign here, please?
Okay, thanks. Great Scott.
What is it, dear?
A telegram from your mother. Listen to this. Barbara, Myrtle, and I coming for visit. Arriving on the 2:45. Have Henry meet us at station. Lovingly, Mother.
Oh, Mother's coming. Isn't that marvelous, dear?
Yeah, great. The last time your mother visited us, she stayed 6 months. Now she's bringing the whole family, and she'll probably stay a year. And you tried to tell me Friday the 13th isn't an unlucky day. Bah.
And so, ladies and gentlemen, after receiving that telegram, no one will be able to convince Henry that Friday the 13th is anything but an unlucky day. Well, au revoir and good luck to you.
Origin of Friday the 13th, Program 13 in the syndicated series The Origin of Superstition from 1935. And with that, we've come to the end of this hour of Old Time Radio. My name is Jake Longwell. Thank you, as always, for your company. Please join me again when you can for more classic sounds from radio's golden age. The Upstate Radio Theater is distributed by Quality Radio Productions.